Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, Boulder City Council talked changes to alternative transportation options on Boulder City streets and bike paths at its meeting last night. We'll have more coming up after headlines. Then we'll hear about the generational divide in the Republican Party when we speak with a young Conservative who's on an electric vehicle road trip across the country to raise awareness about climate change. He says that young Republicans and young Conservatives have this as a big issue that they're concerned about. We spoke with him while he's on one of his stops right here in Colorado. Then we'll have another young voice weighing in on this time what it's like to be a young progressive but in a much more conservative state. We'll hear the story of a CU Boulder student who, due to the coronavirus pandemic, finds themselves in South Carolina during this election season. We'll have two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You and Naturally with Brigitte Mars. Then it's time for the latest headlines from the BBC, followed by a commentary from Jim Hightower. After that, at 8.35, Joe Uhas is in for good old CU. Then at 9 o'clock, we'll hear from local author Alan Carpenter in conversation with Shelley Schlender. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Officials said yesterday that they have pulled some resources off the Calwood Fire in Boulder County. The fire has experienced minimal growth, with up to 14 inches of snow blanketing the area in places. The Daily Camera reports that crews are on patrol status, and as of yesterday, they were going to monitor the fire from a distance. On Tuesday afternoon, the fire remained at 76% containment and 10,105 acres. Some of the resources fighting the wildfires will be moved to other locations in the state. The cause of the Calwood Fire, the largest fire in Boulder County's history, remains under investigation, as is that of the Left Hand Canyon Fire, which is fully contained. The snow also benefited crews on the Cameron Peak Fire and the eastern portion of the East Troublesome Fire, but the Coloradan reports that the fight isn't over. On Monday, Glenn Lewis, a fire behavior analyst, said that for the fire to really go out, it's going to need more moisture on it, and it will need to stay cold for an extended period of time so the moisture can soak into the fuels. The Cameron Peak Fire is at 64% containment. Yesterday, the city of Denver moved to the second highest level of COVID-19 restrictions in an effort to curb the growth of the virus and avoid overwhelming hospitals. Most businesses will be allowed to operate at only a quarter of their capacity, with a maximum of 50 people. Mayor Michael Hancock said that the state health department had asked the city to tighten its restrictions after weeks of climbing coronavirus cases and rising hospitalizations. The Denver Post reports that the Denver Public Schools announced that many of the district's elementary students will go back to remote learning after they had just returned to their classrooms. According to Chalkbeat, Colorado, students in third through fifth grades will return to online learning beginning Monday and attend classes virtually through the end of November. Hancock said that he does not believe that Denver is failing, but blames the resurgence on the lack of a national strategy to contain the virus. State and public health officials repeated warnings Tuesday that Colorado's hospitals are under pressure and the number of patients could exceed available beds by the end of the year. Governor Jared Polis said that if we don't do better in the state, many more Coloradans will die unnecessarily. On Monday, 98 people were hospitalized in Denver, which is more than twice the number at the start of the month. 77% of the intensive care beds were occupied. Boulder County recorded 35 new coronavirus cases Tuesday, and the University of Colorado at Boulder counted 8. Last night, the Broomfield City Council unanimously voted to withdraw their participation from the Rocky Mountain Greenway, which would link the city to Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge and into Boulder County. However, the council held a study session last month to review soil test samples, and there were numerous concerns about the level of plutonium and other issues related to Rocky Flats. The proposed Greenway Trail is 80 miles long from Rocky Mountain Arsenal northeast of Denver all the way to Rocky Mountain National Park through Rocky Flats. The council's action last night means that Broomfield will not allow the trail to cross at Indiana Street, and the city will not move forward with a connection on its Great Western Open Space. Further, the city will not provide more than $100,000 in funding for the project. The Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center issued a release soon after the council's action, saying they commend the Broomfield City Council for their courage and leadership in this important step towards preventing public recreation on Rocky Flats. On Tuesday, a majority of the Boulder Valley School Board indicated their support for a resolution to remove police officers from schools. In addition, the board supports creating options to ensure safety and improve discipline practices. The Daily Camera reports that the move is based on concerns that students of color are more likely to be ticketed, arrested, suspended, or expelled. All but one board member, Donna Myers, indicated support for the resolution. Myers said her experience working with students with intensive needs showed her that police assistance is sometimes needed. She said that she would rather see the district improve training for both SROs and staff members. The board is expected to vote on the resolution at its November 10th meeting. The Sierra Club and other environmental groups filed a lawsuit yesterday asking a judge to overturn land use plans in southwestern Colorado made while a Trump administration official was unlawfully at the helm of the Bureau of Land Management. The Associated Press reports that William Pendley was ordered to be removed from the Land Bureau's top position after Montana Governor Steve Bullock sued the administration because Pendley had never been confirmed by the Senate. The BLM's plan for the Uncompahgre region of Colorado would open new lands to oil and gas development. Opponents contend that the administration approved it without adequate consideration given to climate change, an imperiled species, and other environmental issues. A spokesperson for the agency said in a statement that the environmental groups were trying to impose their radical agenda on the hardworking people of Colorado and were negatively impacting recreation areas, conservation, and energy development. The weather forecast through Sunday is for sunny skies and no precipitation. Today's highs in the metro area will be around 47, and tomorrow 57. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It is 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. No decisions were made, but Boulder City Council is getting closer to new ordinances that will regulate human and electric devices on streets, paths and sidewalks. KGNU's Ros Brown says it's all part of a shared micro-mobility programme the city hopes to roll out in the next year.
Boulder's B-Cycle, which came to town in 2011, has been pretty successful. Records show people made 105,000 trips per year, or about one trip per bike per day. Ridership declined at the start of 2020 due to the pandemic, but rebounded in August and September. But the original corporate funding model for B-Cycle has not worked out, and for the past 2 years, the city has stepped in with about $200,000 to keep it running. Now, the city is preparing to transition to a bicycle sharing program that includes e-bikes and e-scooters on a trial basis. Councilmember Junie Josephs related a personal story about e-bikes. She says she's done a lot of walking on the bike path since the pandemic began.
And I have seen a few of those electric bikes, and it's pretty scary, and I was startled. So I'm not so sure if I agree with the idea of putting electric bikes on the bike path. And again, when you think about it, when you're walking on the bike path, it's very narrow. It's very narrow. So I'm thinking if there's human-powered bicycle and then there's electric vehicle, accidents can happen at any moment. But I'm just thinking it's so narrow and then you have a speeding vehicle just going by.
Fearful the popular e-scooter could overtake the city sidewalks, last year council imposed a moratorium on companies hoping to license the scooters in Boulder. A pilot program was later approved with the option of cancellation should accidents become a problem. In an effort to shift Boulderites away from single-occupancy vehicle trips, the city's Transportation Advisory Board supports allowing human and e-powered vehicles everywhere. But some council members, including Mark Wallach, have reservations.
I have a grave concern about putting electric-powered vehicles on sidewalks generally. I think the protection of pedestrians has to be our first and highest value, especially since some of those pedestrians are going to be children or the elderly or other people who are not quite as nimble in terms of getting out of the way of someone who's careening down the sidewalk with an electric-powered apparatus.
Councilman Bob Yates is concerned about keeping the speed for anything electric at 15 miles per hour and not at 20, a proposal which has been floated.
The impact by being hit at 15 miles an hour is not proportionate to being hit at 20 miles an hour. In other words, 20 miles an hour is not one-third worse it's actually twice as bad because of the way velocity and kinetics work. So I just want us to bear in mind that incremental changes in speed limits have a more than linear impact. So I would very much be in favor of keeping things at 15 miles an hour, and would he actually even welcome a discussion of lowering things below 15, but 15 has to be absolutely the max.
Mayor Sam Weaver says his electric bike has changed his life for the better, but also argued for a lower speed limit to keep others safe.
You know, many bicyclists don't let you know when they're passing on the left. And so I think that's another way of the path thing, that if we do on multi-use paths have a lot more electric powered devices, we need to get people clear that when they're approaching, particularly on these electric devices, which are very quiet, that they need to give pedestrians, particularly, some kind of indication that they're overtaking them.
And Councilmember Adam Schiff even had an idea for how to get CU students on board.
CU generally has like sort of a, hey, welcome to CU curriculum, here's some rules type of things. The general traffic rules might be a really helpful thing to collaborate with CU to have them take 10-question primer as they enter school so that they know the rules going in. Not everybody reads the street signs as they should, but that type of thing, I think, is always a good way to collaborate so that the city and CU are on the same page.
Council members are concerned about how to monitor dismount zones in high-volume pedestrian areas, such as the Pearl Street Mall and Uni Hill. So there's still a lot of issues to be resolved. Nonetheless, in the next few weeks, the city expects to issue a request for proposals to solicit bids from various companies for its new shared micromobility program. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
It's 15 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. The Electric Election 2020 Road Trip is an initiative of the Conservation Coalition. That's formerly known as the American Conservation Coalition. And it's a group of young conservatives who are rallying around environmental action and climate change. The group's founder, Benji Backer, is currently in Colorado, and I caught up with him yesterday while he was in Aspen to talk about his work and the tour.
We are an organization that's dedicated to market-based environmental principles, and we were founded in 2017 to really build an advocacy base around those types of principles. And knowing that to solve climate change and to solve environmental issues, you need to have an innovation market-based approach. And you also need to have both sides at the table. And so when we were looking at this election, the Conservation Coalition and I decided that the best way that we could try to get our message out there, despite COVID and despite the election, was to go across the country in a Tesla X for 50 days to discuss market-based ways to solve climate change and what different communities across the country are doing to solve it, with or without the government's help. And sometimes it's both. And so, you know, we've interviewed Republicans and Democrats. We've interviewed liberal-leaning companies and conservative-leaning companies. We've visited some of the most urban areas like New York City or Minneapolis. And we've also visited some of the most rural areas like the middle of South Dakota, and the middle of Montana. And so we've definitely been able to hit all the different parts of this country to see what's happening on climate change in local communities and how local communities partnered with markets, elected officials, and sound activism can solve some of our biggest challenges.
So when you say a market-based approach, what exactly is that? You know, can you give us some examples?
Well, first of all, market-based can mean a lot of things. And market-based really means that we're allowing the market to start moving in the right direction when it comes to clean technology and clean results in driving down emissions. And the perfect example of this is actually the United States. We haven't had a big climate policy over the past 15 or 20 years, and yet we lead the world in lowering emissions. And while that's nowhere near enough or nowhere where we need to be, it shows the power of where the market can move in the right direction, because companies have been innovating and local communities have been innovating to a point where it's all added up into a decrease in emissions. And so a market-based, you know, mechanism would include General Motors, you know, the big vehicle company going all electric, because they know that's what the consumers want. What that also means is the federal government and the state government working with states and local communities to accelerate the development of clean technology and upgrade our infrastructure to be more green and, you know, have natural solutions like planting trees and restoring wetlands. Those are all sorts of solutions that are market-based, but involve all levels of government as well as the business community. We believe that this issue cannot be tackled via a one-size-fits-all policy, and that you're going to need to take incremental steps in the right direction to solve it. And at the end of the day, that's what we stand for. And we have something called the American Climate Contract, that really lays that out.
So is there a real generational divide now amongst conservatives? Because certainly the spokespeople for conservatives, if we look at the Republican Party, the older generation, many deny that climate change even is an issue, let alone embracing any type of policy to help mitigate it.
No, it's a great point. And honestly, there is a complete generational divide between older conservatives and younger conservatives on the issue of climate change. Young conservatives want answers now, and they want the party to be involved, and the older generations don't see this as big of a priority. And the reason that is because the issue has been so politicized. It is seen as a left of center issue. And if you're conservative and you live in rural America and you don't want DC or New York City or a big city to be telling you what to do, and that's all you've been given as a solution to climate change, you're going to be anti-climate change reform. And so as we traveled across the country, that generational divide has been obvious because we've met with young conservatives who want action as well as older conservatives who have been more skeptical. And they're not skeptical because they don't care about the environment or because they don't even believe that we have a role in how we impact the climate. But it's more because the only solutions they've ever heard of are ones that go against their values and go against their livelihoods. You know, farmers in the Midwest are struggling as is. And if they're being told what to do by the government with every single, you know, climate policy and being hammered into the ground more and more and more, no wonder they're not at the table. And so we have to have a more robust conversation about how we involve people in the climate conversation. And thankfully, that's starting to happen. Despite the presidential level being a little bit more divisive, Republicans in the House and the Senate and Congress, as well as at the state level, are working on these issues in tandem with Democratic elected officials. And you're seeing Republicans put together climate plans for the first time, all bipartisan bills. And so the tide is turning. But the way to turn it faster is to give more people who have felt left behind by this conversation a voice, and then also urge those who are in a position of power to take this issue more seriously.
That's Benji Backer with the Conservation Coalition. He's currently on an electric vehicle tour across the US to talk about environmental issues. I caught up with him yesterday when he was in Aspen. Well, up next, we'll bring you another young voice. It's slightly different, though. What's it like to be a young person who has lived primarily in progressive communities like the Bay Area and Boulder, and then you end up in a very red state, South Carolina, to be precise? We'll see you. Boulder student Zach Seegers brings us this report.
If you've spent much time at all in Boulder, Colorado, you've probably heard the term the Boulder bubble. And even if you haven't, you've probably noticed how Boulder can often feel like its own insulated little community, isolated from the rest of society. We may hear about Trump supporters, the Blue Lives Matter movement in response to Black Lives Matter, and anti-maskers, but rarely, if ever, do we come into contact with that sect of society here in our Boulder bubble. The differences between Boulder and a region like the South have been exacerbated by this election season, the tragic murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and several others, as well as the global pandemic we are currently facing.
In terms of like just the people or the community around, you have a lot of different perspectives.
That's Ben Johnson, a student at CU Boulder and writer for the CU Independent, who has lived in either Boulder, Colorado, or in the Bay Area of California his entire life. That was until coronavirus forced him to move to South Carolina to spend more time with his grandparents and help them around the house. As a result, he's come across a lot of people with very different perspectives from what he's used to in the Bay Area and on the CU campus.
It is a different world in the way that it's very conservative, to say the least, and they're not afraid to promote it. Whereas in either Colorado or the Bay, to a lesser extent in Colorado, but in the Bay Area at least, you very rarely see a proud conservative waving a Confederate flag or even the black flag with a blue stripe or any sort of promotion for Trump. It's very rare to see anything like that. So around here, it's completely different. You have people's signs in yards, flags waving everywhere, Confederate flags everywhere. It's a different world.
One of the ways that South Carolina is most noticeably a very different world from Boulder in the Bay Area, Ben says, is the lack of activity the widespread Black Lives Matter movement has had in South Carolina.
People really don't care as much around here, so you don't really see a lot of people out in the streets protesting, doing that kind of thing.
Something even more observable than the lack of engagement with the Black Lives Matter movement by the surrounding community there in South Carolina has been the general consensus of disapproval and distaste that Ben has noticed in the direction of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Just from what I've heard them say, I know there's a lot of, I wouldn't say hatred, but a strong dislike for the Black Lives Matter movement in general. And hopefully it's due to misunderstanding and not just flat out racism.
It's not difficult to see how that kind of attitude could come to be when the leader of the dominant political ideology in the region says things like this.
The unhinged left-wing mob is trying to vandalize our history, desecrate our monuments, our beautiful monuments, tear down our statues, and punish, cancel, and persecute anyone who does not conform to their demands for absolute and total control. We're not conforming. That's why we're here, actually.
Another key difference between the worlds of Boulder and South Carolina is how often you see pro-Trump symbols, such as apparel that features Trump's Make America Great or Keep America Great slogans, a Confederate flag or the Blue Lives Matter flag. The fandom for Trump and the movement he represents is quite real, especially in the South and in states like South Carolina.
You see it a ton. Like, there is so much of it, especially coming from the Bay Area. I don't know, like, in like comparison to other conservative places, like how much it's really promoted, but it's a lot. Like, you see signs in yards every three or four houses at least, saying Lindsey Graham, saying Trump, very few Biden and Harris stuff, which is disappointing. And you know, you see them waving flags, even like t-shirts or other apparel, hats.
Because he's a white male in the region, Ben doesn't have to fear for his own safety like many others have to, due to this fervent, cult-like fandom for Trump and strongly negative attitude towards the Black Lives Matter movement that occasionally escalates to violence. Ben does worry for members of his family, though, like his half-brother, that are people of color or mixed race, due to potential fallout that we could see following this year's election season.
As election season rolls around, my family, or one of my little brothers, he's mixed race, and like, depending on how this election goes, I'm starting to stress out a little bit about, like, if Trump wins, chaos ensues after this fucking crazy November we're about to have. Where should I be? Like, what part of the family should I, you know, be with? Because they're split up on both sides of the country, so there's a little stress, and comfortability is a little strange, especially around a lot of conservatives.
Overall, though, Ben isn't too terribly uncomfortable in South Carolina. For the most part, he's actually grateful for this experience because it's opened his eyes and made him more aware of the fact that most places aren't like the liberal havens he's lived in the Bay Area of California and Boulder, Colorado.
It's definitely given me a new perspective on, which I really appreciate, of like how different the world is from the West Coast to the East Coast, or from the South to the West Coast, and how, yeah, just how people look at the world, and to realize that, like, even though when you look on, you know, your phone, or you're in the Bay Area and you see all this positive change, that it's not, I mean, I don't really believe in like fighting against anybody, but you know, there is still a battle between the two sides that you can't really recognize all the time when you are in the Bay Area, where there's not really anybody that has a conflicting view.
Ben is certainly grateful for the experience, but he's also hopeful that after this year's election, he'll finally be able to return to some sense of normalcy, which should also hopefully allow him to return to a much more comfortable setting. Thank you. I'm Zach Seegers.
And Zach Seegers is a student reporter at CU Boulder. You're listening to KGNU. Time now for Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you. Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. Every week, I will remind you it's time to get out the vote. Try to find at least 10 people you can convince to vote. To reach Generation Z, you can work with the Civic Center's nonpartisan Postcards for Democracy initiative. Also, one of the top 10 reasons people don't vote is because they can't get to the polls. Uber and Lyft are offering half-price rides to the polls on Election Day only, and you may want to offer a free ride. Text messaging is an effective way to encourage voting, especially since door-to-door canvassing is not recommended right now. Headcount.org is hosting local and national nonpartisan Get Out the Vote text banking events every day until November 2nd. Training is provided and your personal information is never included in the texts, so you can participate anonymously from home. All you need is a web browser, and tell everyone if they feel intimidated at the polls for any reason, call immediately at 1-866-OUR-VOTE. That's 866-OUR-VOTE. Now for an update on the HEROES Act, a revised and trimmed-down version of which was passed by the House a few weeks ago. 74% of voters support prompt Senate action on the updated HEROES Act. That's H.R. 8406, which was passed in the House. Nancy Pelosi's self-imposed Friday deadline, of course, has come and gone, but she says, quote, "We are waiting for the final yes." She's hopeful to work out the final details on national testing and unemployment aid, two unresolved topics separating both sides. Many have thrown cold water on the prospect of pushing a bill through, one that would include a second stimulus check of up to $1,200. Among some Senate Republicans, opposition has been fierce, but others have signaled their tacit support. Trump has hinted he would pressure Senate Republicans to pass the vote. Economists in the top echelons of government have stressed the need for stimulus aid. Quote, "Too little support would lead to a slower and weaker recovery," said Lael Brainard, who sits on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. On October 1st, the House of Representatives passed that revised HEROES Act that includes a second stimulus check and additional benefits such as enhanced unemployment benefits for tens of millions of Americans. Proposals from both sides have included another stimulus payment of up to $1,200, aid for airlines, enhanced unemployment insurance, and extending the Paycheck Protection Program for businesses. Although the Senate's targeted bills do not include stimulus checks, in the past, Republicans, including those in the Senate, have supported them. Both Democrats and Republicans have their political reasons not to pass a compromise bill, but millions of individuals and hundreds of thousands of small businesses will fall through the cracks if they have to wait until after January 20th to see an economic rescue bill get passed. So if you have thoughts on the House's HEROES Act and the need for a compromise bill to pass now, you can contact your senators and House member, and by all means, get out that vote. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
And it's time now for Naturally.
Greetings. Welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. I've been going up the chakras, really considering what are some of the gems that we can get from this time of pandemonium or whatever you want to call it. Definitely a time of chaos. Are there any benefits? Sometimes great change and evolution comes from trying times. And if you don't know what the word chakra means, it means wheel of light. And I'm sure you've seen pictures of a rainbow going through our body, red, orange, yellow. And yellow lands us at the solar plexus area, the hara. And this is an area where we really want to think about how can we improve our health and our immunity and what foods we choose to put into our body. Are we building health? Are we undermining our health? Are we consuming things that maybe we're allergic to that cause us to be overly phlegmy or congested? Do addictions affect our health? If we're abusing caffeine, tobacco, alcohol, these might impair our health more so than any exposure to a virus. I'm a big believer in eating all the colors of the rainbow. So no matter what your diet is, can you find opportunities to eat more red foods, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet? We might also help our immunity by including more fermented foods, things like unpasteurized miso, unpasteurized apple cider vinegar, sauerkraut. Sauerkraut is a great way to get probiotics into our system. And if you're going to use sauerkraut, I'd suggest getting the refrigerated variety that is full of probiotics. Most sauerkraut that just sits on a shelf in a grocery store, even though it might have been fermented at one time, is then pasteurized so it has a longer shelf life. So make sure you get the unpasteurized variety. Learning to use a wide range of culinary herbs and spices can also be very immune supportive. If you're wanting to include some things that help to destroy bacteria, fungi, and viruses, your allies are in your spice shelf. When you look at cinnamon, oregano, garlic, onions, basil, and thyme. And we're being told how important vitamin C is. So, of course, you can take a vitamin C tablet, but you can eat tart apples and things like berries and kiwi. So really, rather than thinking that there's nothing we can do to empower our health, there's so much that we can do. And what a joy to participate in activating a healthy immunity. Thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.
You can hear Brigitte Mars and Naturally Wednesday mornings right here at KGNU.